19. The Birthday Hero. The room was not very big and not very high. It had two doors, and what may once have been a window and was now blocked up, flush with the wall. The air, however, was fresh and pleasant. A special engineer was responsible for its circulation and chemical purity. A great deal of space was occupied by a low ottoman with flowery cushions. Twin lamps with pink shades were attached to the wall above it. On the ottoman lay a man whose likeness has been more often sculpted, painted in oils, watercolours, gouache and sepia, limned in charcoal, chalk and powdered brick, pieced together in a mosaic of roadmaker's gravel or seashells or wheat grains or soybeans, etched on ivory, grown in grass, woven into carpets, spelled out by planes flying in formation, recorded on film than any other face ever has been in the 3 billion years since the Earth's crust was formed. Now he was just lying there, with his legs in soft Caucasian boots like thick stockings. He was wearing a service jacket with two big breast pockets and two big side pockets, an old, well-worn tunic of the sort he had worn, some of them khaki, some black, since the Civil War, perhaps in imitation of Napoleon, and had changed for a marshal's uniform only after Stalingrad. The man's name was declaimed by all the newspapers of the terrestrial globe, mouthed by thousands of announcers in hundreds of languages, thundered by public speakers in their exordia and perorations, piped by the thin voices of young pioneers, intoned in prayers for his health by bishops. This man's name burned on the parched lips of prisoners of war and the swollen gums of convicts. It had replaced the previous names of a multitude of cities and squares, streets and avenues, palaces, universities, schools, sanatoriums, mountain ranges, ship canals, factories, mines, state farms, collective farms, warships, icebreakers, fishing boats, cooperative cobblers' shops, nurseries. And a group of Moscow journalists had even suggested renaming the Volga and the Moon after him. Yet he was only a little yellow-eyed old man with gingery, not pitch black as in his portraits, thinning, luxuriant according to his portraits, hair, with deep pockmarks in a grey face and a sagging dewlap. These last features were not portrayed at all, with uneven, blackened teeth, a mouth smelling of pipe tobacco, and fat, moist fingers that left marks on documents and books. Moreover, he was not feeling very well today. He had gotten tired and had overeaten during the Jubilee celebrations. There was a weight like a stone in his stomach, and belching left a sour taste in his mouth. Salol and belladonna had not helped, and he did not like taking purgatives. He hadn't dined at all today, and had decided around midnight, quite early for him, to lie down for a bit. Although the air was warm, his back and shoulders felt cold, and he had covered them with a brown mohair shawl. A deathly silence had flooded the house and grounds and all the world. In this silence, time seemed scarcely to stir, scarcely to crawl. It had to be lived through like an illness, and every night he had to invent some business or some distraction. It was easy enough to shut yourself off from the spatial universe, refuse to move about in it, but it was impossible to shut yourself off from time. Right now he was paging through a little book in a stiff brown binding. He looked with satisfaction at the photographs, dipped into the text, which he knew almost by heart, and turned more pages. The book was designed to slip comfortably into an overcoat pocket without bending. It could accompany people wherever they went, whatever they did. It had 250,000 pages, but they were sparsely covered with bold print so that even the semi-literate and the aged could read them without fatigue. The title was stamped on the cover in gilt letters. Iosif Vissarionovich Stalin. Short biography. The honest and unpretentious words of this book sank irresistibly into the human heart, bringing peace. The strategist of genius. His wisdom and foresight. His iron will. From 1918 onward he was, in effect, Lenin's deputy. Yes, yes, I was. When he became leader of the revolutionary armies, he found chaos and panic at the front. Stalin's instructions formed the basis of Frunze's plan of operations. True, true, that's just how it was. It was our great good fortune that in the difficult years of the Fatherland War we were led by a wise and experienced leader, the great Stalin. Yes, the people had been lucky. Everybody knows the shattering power of Stalin's logic, the crystal clarity of his mind. No need for false modesty, it's all true. His love for the people, his sensitive concern for the people, his intolerance of pomp and publicity, his extraordinary modesty. Modesty, yes, that's very true. His infallible knowledge of men had enabled the celebrant to collect a good team of authors for his biography. But however thorough they are, however they slave at it, no one else can write about your deeds, your leadership, your qualities as cleverly, with as much feeling and as truthfully as you can yourself. So Stalin sometimes had to summon this or that member of the team for a leisurely talk, in order to inspect their manuscript, gently indicating where they had gone wrong and suggesting improvements in the wording. As a result, the book was now a great success. This second edition had come out in 5 million copies. For such a huge country? Not nearly enough. The third edition must be boosted to 10 million or 20. It must be on sale in factories, schools, collective farms. It should be distributed to them directly, according to the number of employees. Nobody knew as well as Stalin did how much his people needed this book. His people could not be left without continual instruction and edification. His people must not be kept in uncertainty. The revolution had left them orphaned and godless, and that was dangerous. Stalin had spent 20 years doing his best to correct that situation. This explained the millions of portraits throughout the country. It was not Stalin himself who needed them. He was modest. The constant, thunderous repetition of his glorious name, the unfailing mention of him in every article. The leader himself had absolutely no need of all this. It no longer gave him any pleasure. He had grown sick of it long ago. It was his subjects who needed it, the simple Soviet people. As many portraits, as many repetitions of his name as possible. But he himself must appear seldom and say little, as though he were not always with them on this earth, but at times in some other place. That way there was no limit to their rapturous adoration. It was not nausea, but a sort of heavy upward pressure from the stomach. He took a feijoa from a bowl of peeled fruit. 3 days ago salvos had hailed his glorious 70th birthday. To the Caucasian way of thinking, a septuagenarian is still in his prime, able to tackle a mountain, a horse, or a woman. And Stalin was still perfectly fit. He simply had to live to 90. He had set his heart on it. There was so much to be done. True, one doctor had warned him about never mind what. The man had apparently been shot later. No, there was nothing seriously wrong with him. He refused injections and therapy of any sort. He knew enough about medicines to prescribe for himself. Eat more fruit, they told him. As if a Caucasian needed to be told about fruit. He sucked the pulp of the feijoa, screwing up his eyes. It left a faint tang of iodine on his tongue. Yes, he was perfectly fit, but he noticed certain changes as the years went by. He had lost his hearty appetite. There was nothing he savoured. Eating had begun to bore him. He no longer delighted in selecting wine for each dish. Tipsiness simply gave him a headache. If Stalin sometimes sat over a meal half the night with his mini-leaders, it was just to kill the long, empty hours, not because he enjoyed the food. Women, too, were something he needed rarely and never for long, although he had indulged himself freely after Nadia's death. They did not thrill him, but left him feeling dulled. Nor did sleep bring relief as it had when he was younger. He woke up feeling weak and muddle-headed and reluctant to rise. Though he had decided to live to 90, Stalin thought miserably. He personally could expect no pleasure from the years ahead. He must simply accept another 20 years of suffering for the sake of mankind at large. This was how he had celebrated his birthday. On the evening of the 20th, Trycho Kostov had been done to death. Only when the dog's eyes glazed over could the real celebrations begin. On the 21st, Stalin had been feted in the Bolshoi Theatre, where Mao, Dolores, and other comrades had made speeches. Then there had been a great banquet. Still later, an intimate banquet. They had drunk old wine from Spanish cellars, wine once sent in payment for arms. Then he and Lavrenti privately had drunk Kakhetinskoye and sung Georgian songs. On the 22nd there was a big diplomatic reception. On the 23rd he had seen himself portrayed on screen in The Battle of Stalingrad, Part 2, and on the stage in The Unforgettable 1919. He had liked both productions, although they left him exhausted. His role, not only in the Fatherland War, but in the Civil War too, was more and more truthfully portrayed nowadays. Everyone could see what a great man he had been even then. Stage and screen now showed people how often he had warned and corrected the rash and superficial Lenin. What noble words the playwright had put in his mouth. Every toiler has the right to say what he thinks. And how cleverly the scriptwriter had handled that night scene with his friend. Although Stalin no longer had such a close and devoted friend, because people were always so insincere, so treacherous. And, as it happened, he had never had such a friend, no, never. But when he saw it on screen, Stalin felt a lump in his throat. What a writer! That's what I call a writer! It was as if he had always wanted such a truthful and selfless friend, someone to whom you could say out loud the thoughts that came to you in the long night hours. But you couldn't possibly have such a friend, because he would have to be very, very great. And if he were as great as that, where would he live? What would his job be? As for all those others, from Vyacheslav Stonebottom to Nikita the Hopak dancer, how could anyone take them seriously? You could die of boredom sitting at the table with them. Not one of them ever came out with a clever remark, and whenever you made a point, they all agreed immediately. At one time Stalin had a soft spot for Voroshilov, because of Tsaritsyn and the Polish campaign, and because he had reported the meeting of those traitors, Zinoviev and Kamenev, with Frunze in the cave at Kislovodsk. But Voroshilov was a stuffed dummy with an army cap and medals, not a human being. There was no one he now remembered as a friend, no one of whom he could remember more good than bad. He had and could have no friend. But the common people all loved their leader and were ready to sacrifice life and soul for him. That was made clear by the newspapers, the cinema, and the exhibition of birthday presents. He rejoiced to think that the leader's birthday had become a nationwide festival. So many birthday messages had arrived, greetings from institutions, from organizations, from factories, from individual citizens. Pravda had asked permission to publish them, not all at once, but in two columns daily. Publication would extend over several years, but that was all to the good. As for the presents, 10 galleries in the Museum of the Revolution could not house them. So that the citizens of Moscow could view them freely in the daytime, Stalin paid a visit by night. The work of thousands and thousands of craftsmen, the finest gifts earth could offer, stood, lay, or hung before him. But here, too, the same cold indifference, the same apathy had gripped him. What good were all these presents to him? He was soon bored with them. Once again, there in the museum, an unpleasant memory stirred at the back of his mind, but as so often recently, the thought remained vague. He knew only that it was unpleasant. Stalin walked through 3 galleries without choosing anything, pausing for a moment at the big television set with an engraved plate reading, "To Great Stalin from the Czechists." This, the biggest of all Soviet television sets, and the only one of its kind, had been made at Marfino. Stalin inspected it briefly, turned on his heel, and left. But, by and large, it had been a marvellous occasion. His proud record, his victories, achievements such as no political leader in the world could equal. Yet for him, this triumphant occasion had been hollow. It was as though something lodged in his chest nagged and galled him. He took another bite of the fechoa and sucked it. Yes, the people loved him, but the people's faults were innumerable. Left to itself, the people was good for nothing. You need only ask yourself who was to blame for the retreat in 1941. Who retreated? The people, who else? That was why he ought not to be celebrating or lying around, but getting down to work, thinking. Thinking. That was his duty. at once his lot and his punishment. He had to live another 2 decades, like a prisoner serving a 20-year sentence, with no more than 8 hours sleep in the 24. That was all he could manage. All those other hours he must struggle through, as though he were dragging his aging, vulnerable body over sharp stones. Hardest of all for Stalin were morning and early afternoon. While the sun was rising, shining merrily, reaching its zenith, Stalin slept in darkness, shuttered, secluded, secret. He awoke when the sun was already declining, losing strength, toward the end of its short one-day life. Stalin had breakfast at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but began to come to life only toward evening, when the sun was setting. In the hours between, his brain was warming up, waking sullenly, distrustfully. He could make only negative and prohibitive decisions. Dinner began at 10 p.m. A few favored members of the Politburo or foreign communists were usually invited. 4 or 5 hours were painlessly killed over a steady succession of dishes, drinks, jokes, and discussions. And at the same time his mind picked up speed, and the impetus for the creative, legislative thinking of the second half of the night was generated. All the major decrees that kept the great state on course took shape in Stalin's head after 2 a.m. and never later than dawn. That time had come around again, and a decree conspicuously lacking in the body of the law was ripening. He had made fast forever almost everything in the land, stopped all movement, dammed all currents. All 200 million knew their place, but the kolkhoz system had sprung a leak. This was all the stranger, because the general situation on the farms was conspicuously good. Witness the films and novels on the subject. And anyway, Stalin often talked to collective farmers himself on the platforms of rallies and congresses. Nonetheless, like the perspicacious and unceasingly self-critical statesman he was, Stalin had forced himself to look still deeper. One of the Abkom secretaries, subsequently shot, he believed, had let slip that the farms had one dark side. Old men and women enrolled in the 30s worked ungrudgingly, but an unconscientious element among the young tried, when they left school, to obtain passports by fraud and to sneak off to the towns. Education! What a mess they had got into with first universal 7-year, then universal 10-year education, with those children of cooks who now went to university. Lenin, in his irresponsible way, had muddled matters, recklessly littering the place with promises, which had since become a crippling burden to his successor, to Stalin. Any cook must be able to administer the state. But how had Lenin pictured this in concrete terms? Did he mean that the cook, instead of cooking on Fridays, would take her seat on the Oblast Executive Committee? A cook was a cook. Her job was to prepare dinner. Governing people was a rare skill, a task that could be entrusted only to special cadres, cadres specially selected, trained and tempered, highly disciplined. Management of the cadres themselves must rest in a single pair of hands, the practiced hands of the leader. Why not write it into the statutes of each collective farm that since the land belongs to it in perpetuity, everyone born in a particular village automatically acquires membership in the farm at birth? Represent this as a right and an honor. Launch a public relations campaign immediately. A further step along the road to communism. Youth's inheritance, the collective granary. Well, the writers would find the best way to put it. Somehow his mind was not on his work today. He felt unwell. There were 4 short knocks, or rather not so much knocks as a muffled sound, as if a dog was pawing the door. Stalin pulled a lever near his couch, the safety catch clicked, and the door opened slightly. No curtain hung in front of it. Stalin did not like anything that hung loosely, anything with folds in which someone could hide. And he could see the bed door opening just wide enough to admit a dog. It was, however, at the upper, not the lower, end of the gap that a head appeared, that of the bald, though still young-looking Poskryobyshov, who wore a permanent expression of honest devotion and unbounded eagerness to serve. Though it worried him to see the boss lying down, half-covered with a mohair shawl, he did not ask about his health. Stalin disliked such questions, but said, almost in a whisper, "Iosif Vissarionovich, You made an appointment with Abakumov for 2:30. Will you be wanting to see him?
Yosef Vissarionovich unbuttoned the flap of his breast pocket and pulled out a watch on a chain. Like all those of his generation, he detested wristwatches. It was not yet 2 a.m. The heavy lump was still there in his stomach. He didn't feel like getting up and changing his clothes. But he could not relax his grip on any of them. The slightest weakening would be felt at once.
"We'll see," said Stalin, wearily blinking. "I'm not sure."
"He might as well come. He can wait,"
Paskryabyshov said, nodded 3 or 4 times, then froze again, looking expectantly at the boss.
"Have you any further instructions, Yosiryonich?"
No instructions could be read into the languid, lifeless gaze that Stalin turned on him. But Paskryabyshov's question had struck a sudden spark from his erratic memory, and he asked something that he had intended to ask long ago but kept forgetting.
"What about the cypresses down in the Crimea? Are they being cut down?"
"They are, Yosiryonich,"
Paskryabyshov nodded confidently, as though he had been expecting this very question, and had just rung through to the Crimea to inquire.
"Around Massandra and Livadia, a lot of them have been felled already, Yosiryonich."
"Have a report sent in, just the same. In code. Make sure there's no sabotage."
The unhealthy yellow eyes of the all-powerful looked troubled. One of his doctors had told him earlier in the year that cypresses were bad for his health, and that he needed air impregnated with the aroma of eucalyptuses. Whereupon Stalin had given orders for the Crimean cypresses to be felled, and eucalyptus saplings to be imported from Australia. Paskryabyshov acknowledged his orders, and also undertook to find out what was happening with the eucalyptuses.
"Right," said Stalin, satisfied. "You can go for now, Sasha."
Paskryabyshov nodded, backed toward the door, inclined his head once more, then withdrew it and closed the door. Yosef Vissarionovich operated the remote control lock again. Clutching the shawl, he turned onto his other side, and he continued paging through his biography. But recumbency, a slight chill, and indigestion had lowered his resistance, and he surrendered helplessly to dark thoughts. What rose before him now was not the dazzling and preordained success of his policies, but his ill luck in life and all the enemies, all the obstacles with which fate had sought to bar his way.